We have to stop designing for the average brain.
We haven't evolved to live in concrete boxes.
What if you could leave the office being more energized than when you came in the morning?
What you end up having is lower burnout rates, less stress, more sustainable workplaces.
What if our workplaces were designed not just for productivity, but for well-being, for all of us? Today, we're exploring how neuroscience and neurodesign are fundamentally reshaping our workplaces for a healthier, more inclusive future. Joining us is Dr. Elizabeth Nelson, a scientist, author, and advisor specializing in how environments influence performance and well-being. Her book, The Healthy Office Revolution, is a key resource for building smarter, healthier, higher-performing teams. Elizabeth, great to have you here.
So great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Anna Wisniewska, Vice President of Communications and Marketing for Skanska's commercial development business in Central Europe. Anna brings 15 years of insights into how workplaces are evolving to meet people's needs. Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Starting with you, Elizabeth, in your research and experience, what are the most overlooked aspects of well-being in office design? And why do companies miss out on something that's so important?
I think the biggest mistake that we're making or overlook is we put too much emphasis on normal. And normal ends up statistically being less than 10% of us. So we're designing for this this elite population, actually. It's usually the people who go into management, the people who are very resilient, the people who do very well in the office. I think in terms of overlooking things, just the curiosity maybe, and looking at we're all very different, and that's great. That's what we need. We don't need all of the same person doing something that's difficult and distinct and individual. We need a bunch of different people working on different angles to get something amazing done.
You emphasize the connection between neuroscience and workplace design. How can understanding the brain help us overcome this cookie cutter and help us design better offices?
Yeah, well, I'm a biomedical engineer, and I did a bunch of big studies in offices. And I think the quintessential change that happened was we were doing research at Booking.com, which is an amazing tech company, right? And we had a very wide range of people. So we had the tech nerds and the engineers and computer scientists, and we had the account people, and we had this wide range of types of people, which a lot of workplaces have now. And you can't study a workplace like that and ignore neuroscience and neuroarchitecture.
Are there some practical examples of design choices that support cognitive health here?
Yeah, there's a lot. And we're doing a lot of things right, and we're doing a lot of things wrong. Different things that work with our natural rhythms, aspects that we've seen in biological design. You know, hospitals have done this amazing job at using biological design, biophilia, to help people de-stress before surgeries or while recovering. They recover faster. And it just shows that we haven't evolved to live in concrete boxes. Mm. So different aspects of working in your own rhythms. And that's very distinct. So I'm an extreme, you know, I'm an introvert, and I'm not a morning person. I'm everything that would fail in corporate life, right? I often ask when I do talks, are you a 5 to 9, 9 to 5, or 5 to 9? So are you a morning person, the typical workday, or an evening person? And I'm an evening person. And I have magic then, but I also have kids and a job. So I'm just jet lagged all the time, right? I'm working at a time that isn't normal for me. And how do you do that? So I think the first step in workplaces is allowing different types of people to lean into who they are.
It's always good to come back to ourselves. We're going to get into some of those aspects like biophilia a little bit later on. But Anna, your team coordinated the creation of the first comprehensive report on neuro-inclusive workplaces in Poland. And I'm going to try and get this right. Neurodiversity in the Office, How to Create Neuro-Inclusive Workplaces. You did this together with neuroscientists and architects and workplace experts. Can you tell us something about the findings?
I think the most important finding is that we have to stop designing for the average brain, and we have to start designing for different brains. And it may sound quite impossible, because how do we know what is inside of each of our heads. But the designing for different brains is really giving choice for people. And giving choice is through creating options. And I can give some examples. Individual working space. You can have a huge open space with desks and computers, or you can create more cozy zones where you have a very clear distinction between the loud area where you are allowed to talk. And that's especially for people with ADHD who want to consult, who thrive when there is a buzz. Or you can have people who cannot work in an environment where there are sounds. So by creating those areas of quiet areas, loud areas, you create choice. You can also give choice connected with the light. You can give choice connected with the temperature. And then we go to the cooperation areas, which typically these are conference rooms and typically they are quite similar, meaning that there's a table and there are chairs that are the same around the table. And when we think about different brains, when we think about giving people choice, maybe we should think that some of those conference rooms, they can have different furnitures. They can have different seating arrangements instead of a big table. Maybe we should have balls, or maybe instead of having just one table, we could have a second row where people who don't want to actively participate in the conversation, they can listen, because that's how they are at their best at work. And then that leads me to the third area that you usually see in the office space, which is a restoration area. And depending on who you ask, people can restore in a very active way. So we have colleagues who would like to play some foosball. And we have people like myself who sometimes just need some quiet. And I need to restore. I need to have a dimmed light. And by providing those choices to people, that's where we create the biggest difference.
Hmm. Yeah, a broad range of things, as you say, catering for a broad range of people. How do you translate these insights into actual design and construction decisions? I mean, what sort of steps are developers like Skanska taking to create spaces that support this?
If we compare the office building to a smartphone, smartphone has the hardware and the software. The hardware, like the screen, the box, and then the software, meaning the applications. In office building, it's quite similar. So the developer is responsible for the hardware, for the ventilation. It matters what type of ventilation you choose, whether it's the quiet one or it's a humming one. It matters how thick the walls are. If they are thick enough, then you will not hear the elevator ding every time it arrives on the floor. It's also in the hardware, we also decide on what kind of lighting we put in the common areas, but also how we design the common areas. Let's take the garage. Is getting from your car to the elevator a maze, or is it simple wayfinding? But then the software, the applications. It is our customers, the tenants, who decide how they want their office to look like. However, we as the developer, we are also here to help, because we have worked with many customers on numerous fit outs, space plans, and we hear what works, what doesn't work. And we are also here to support those choices so that our customers' employees have the choice.
And come back to you, Elizabeth. A lot of these features are about how we feel about our experiences and so on. What role does sensory experience play in inclusive design?
Oh, it's huge. There are people who are more sensitive to it, right? But we're all, our biology reacts to environments no matter whether we register it or not. And one thing that I would love more designers to lean into, and I think they really are already drawn to this, is designing for sensitivities. So design for the most sensitive people at the office, because what you'll end up doing is you'll have spaces that really serve them. And sometimes this can get misunderstood. We often design spaces and research is saying, oh, if someone's autistic, they don't want a lot of stimuli around or they're neurodiverse. So we end up putting them in these white boxes with nothing going on there. But if you design for the most sensitive, what you end up having is lower burnout rates, less stress, more sustainable workplaces for the people who don't have the internal alarm bells as loudly. You learn from the people who have the loudest alarms, if you will. And that's what's the power in leaning into neurodiversity and neuroarchitecture and neurodiverse design.
You both mentioned biophilic design, which is a fascinating concept, and I'm starting to see more and more of it. It's not just about putting some potted plants around, is it? What is biophilic design? What does it really mean?
It's fascinating. One of the things that we're seeing is we relax to an incredible point from biophilic design. So I worked with a surgery center that put the most hideous wall mural I've ever seen. It was a Hawaiian postcard of a sunset kind of feel. The anesthesiologist said, I can give people so much less anesthesia before surgery because they're calmer, because their blood pressure's lower from this hideous
mural. Wow.
Yeah. And different aspects. We're seeing that there's an element not only of having plants around, but having plants in a way that almost feels like a barrier, like protection, like coverage. And it's just learned evolution, right? We're not a predatory animal with big teeth and large claws. We are here because of our brains and staying away from danger and not dealing with it once it showed up. So there's elements of having coverage and having coverage from nature that really soothe our biology. But I also heard about some interesting science, which makes a ton of sense. But they say you have to be careful with the plants you choose, because if you choose plants that have different fractals, and I don't understand this to a huge extent, but basically plants that don't belong together, your brain can go, wait a second, where are we? What's going on? This isn't natural. So there is some element of that. But overall, yeah, green everywhere, if you can.
Anna, do you have I haven't had a chance to read all the report, but is there anything there on biophilia and what it actually means for employees and people in an office space?
Even apart from the report, but I can share from my office perspective, each year we have this survey. How do you feel in the office? What would you like to improve? And each year we get information, please add more plants. And the funny thing is that on our floor, we already have over 300 plants, 300. But what I also want to share is, and that's my favorite example connected with biophilic design, is a few years ago, we were developing a skyscraper in Warsaw. And we had, usually skyscrapers have those double height ceilings, so quite a large lobby. And we had this wall, 15 meters by 22 meters, and we covered it with over 6,000 plants. And it looks amazing, but it's not only how it looks, it produces enough oxygen that would last for 24 hours for 150 people. So you can imagine what kind of climate those plants create in this lobby. So I love biophilic design. And also the report tells us, just like Elizabeth said, that people need to be in the nature. People like nature. They feel calmer. So whenever we can include plants, we do it, and we should be doing that.
I noticed in our office space, there are certain floors that have much more timber and natural fabrics and textures on the walls and things like that, and they just feel so much more refreshing and warmer and energizing than the ones that have concrete with maybe a painting. So we're hearing that neuro-inclusive design is gaining attention, but it's not top of mind for a lot of companies and organizations. Elizabeth, what are the first steps that companies should take? How can they move from understanding and being aware of this to taking action?
So I think the first steps are really looking at the biology of people and maybe also relabeling it, where you talk about this is something that's leaning into everyone's biology. And thank God we have these neurodiverse individuals with these strong alarm bells who are telling us like, oh, we can do better with the light. We can do better with the oxygen level and with the plants or with feelings of feeling safe or that we can focus and get into that.
Anna, hearing what Elizabeth was just saying there, from a developer's point of view, are you seeing demand for this from the customers? Are they asking for these sort of aspects to be included?
Some customers are asking, quite a few from the Nordics. If the customers are not asking, then I spoke with my leasing colleagues who work with the customers, with the tenants, and they prepare the space plans. And what I know is that they also try to incorporate some easy to fix solutions, like the separation of the quiet open space from the loud open space. They propose that the kitchens should be closed and the coffee points should be closed so that those noises don't trigger people who need silence to focus. So answering the question, we already hear the questions, also because our customers, they really want their employees to be at their best at work. And if we don't hear those questions, then we take it also as our responsibility to propose, to ask. And that's also why we decided to publish the report, so that more people find out about the needs of designing for different brains, because sometimes it's just lack of knowledge.
Yeah. And there is this evolution happening. In fact, Anna, that brings me, we said before that you've been with Skanska for 15 years, I think it is now. How have our workspaces evolved in that time?
Oh, I remember those huge open space with rows of desks. Then we remember the cubicles. Then we went into the activity-based working. And that for me was great until I realized that I don't have a desk and I feel lost. So fantastic was that I was able to choose a place to work depending on what the task was for me. But then the lack of this anchor when I come in the morning of having the desk made us realize also that we have to do some changes to the activity-based working, because some people just cannot work in an environment like that. And then, so from the open space to activity-based working, now we are in the moment of time when we really put our well-being, our employees' well-being into focus, and we are thinking how the space resonates with people, how people perceive the space, how the space influences us. So it's quite a journey, and I am very happy that I got to experience that. And I think we still have a lot to learn and to implement in order for us to be at our best at work, and in order for us to really get energy back also throughout the day and not only leave the energy in the office.
It's going to be very interesting to see where things take us now. And on that point, turning to you, Elizabeth, looking ahead, what do you see as the next frontier in creating workplaces that are really supporting mental health and inclusivity?
I think we're going to have a big push from certain employees in the workforce. I think we're going to have a big push from high performers, from women, some of the people that companies are most aware that they're losing. And I really think one of the things I'm working more with companies is getting employees able to get into flow states during the day. It's amazing for our chemical makeup. We have this incredible output. We have dopamine. We have all of these fantastic hormones working in our brain that lead us into the next day. And it can be this incredible thing to maintain. from a biological standpoint and very satisfying. So if you can get your employees into flow states a few times a week or magically every day, it can be very similar to what we see with professional athletes, where they are addicted almost to that routine that they have, to getting into the flow state, to getting working in that way. So I think we're going to have a push from certain employees and just, that kind of desperation to keep some of the best and brightest for the type of workspace that gets us into our individual but very beneficial best work states.
Watch this space. Thank you both so much for a really exciting and stimulating discussion. We all spend so much time in the office and in the workplace that making it work better it should be more prioritized, and it's good that we're doing that for everyone. So Elizabeth Nelson, Anna Wisniewska, both thank you very much for being on Shaping Sustainable Places.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
As we've heard from both of our guests, the critical shift from designing for an average brain to embracing newer inclusive environments is vital if we want our workplaces to really step up. Anna and Elizabeth highlighted how these spaces offer choice, cater to diverse sensory needs, and integrate natural elements through biophilic design. It's clear that by understanding our biology and championing these design principles, we can create spaces that not only boost mental health and productivity, but also create a more sustainable and human-centered future for work. Thank you for listening today. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform and reach out either on the Skanska Group account on LinkedIn or by emailing us at podcast@skanska.com. Until next time, I'm John Ambrose, and this is Shaping Sustainable Places.